Hey, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Living the Good Life show live from Dallas. We got lots going on, of course. We're going to get into it. Finally, the draft is over, and we can breathe a little bit. And we've got a nice segment coming your way here. We're not going to talk sports. Maybe we will, actually. I don't know. We'll see about that. We've got our next guest here who probably needs no introduction. I mean, I am a big fan. I grew up watching so many great movies that he starred in. D.B. Sweeney, welcome to the show. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. And, you know, I want to get into it, and I want to talk about some of my most favorite films that you have starred in. But I want to kind of bring everyone up to speed on how you even entered the world of film and television. I know you started in theater. You still are very active when it comes to stage work. But talk a little bit about the process and how you got into it.
Yeah, well, I originally thought I was going to be a baseball player. I went to Tulane University to play baseball there, and I got injured and was dispatched from the program for disciplinary reasons connected to the injury. So I transferred to NYU. I'm from New York. My sister was there. It was not like the way it is now, where NYU is like, it's like trying to get into Yale. You know, it was a little easier.
Okay.
And I decided, my dad was a guidance counselor in a high school on Long Island, not mine, but nearby. He said, if you don't finish college, you'll never go back. So I thought, well, that sounds like a good advice. So, but I really didn't want to go to do anything besides play baseball. So I had done a play as an actor in high school and had a good experience, like a senior year kind of thing. And so I decided I'd go to NYU for acting because I thought it would be easy and that there would be girls involved.
Yeah.
And I was right on one out of two.
Yeah. Well, you clearly were a natural talent. And I want to ask you about how Francis Ford Coppola even found you and took you basically under his wing. I mean, you did a phenomenal movie. What was that like? Gardens of the Stone has got to be one of your first movies,
yeah.
The leading point of your career.
Yeah, that was a transformative moment for me. You know, I had been doing a lot of theater. I'd done like a guest spot with the late, great Robert Urich on Spencer for Hire. I'd done a few other things, a small movie called Fire with Fire.
Okay.
Beautiful Virginia Madsen and my friend Craig Sheffer. So I dipped my toe in the water and I was sort of getting a little bit of affirmation that, wow, I might be able to scratch out a career here. And then I met Fred Roos, who is a legendary casting director. He cast The Godfather, The Conversation, The Outsiders. He discovered all those guys, C. Thomas Howell, Matt Dillon, you know, and he's the guy, one of the reasons why Al Pacino's in The Godfather. So, you know, he's a legendary kind of guy. And I met him on a very forgettable movie called 7 Minutes in Heaven. And it was for the role, a 3-scene role, Jennifer Connelly's first movie, by the way, so Fred discovered her as well. She was about 14 years old, and she and her friend in the movie are just, you know, teenage girls, and one of them starts this romance with a big league ball player who has like 3 scenes. And Fred was convinced, because of my background and everything, that I was the perfect guy for this movie, but he couldn't convince the woman who was directing the movie. And later, Fred told me it made him so angry that he was determined to make me a star and prove her wrong. So 6 months later, he brings me in to meet Francis Coppola on Gardens of Stone. And I went through a very long process of auditions. Towards the end of the process, I knew I was in the mix. And I started to try to persuade Francis to put me in one of the supporting parts because I knew they would never give me the main role. So I wanted to be part of it. And I guess he was very charmed by that I just wanted to be in the movie. So, and then I ended up playing the main role. And before the movie was even out, you know, I was already kind of on everybody's list in Hollywood being offered movies sight unseen.
I mean, from Memphis Belle, which is one of my most favorites. And of course, probably, I mean, growing up in the 80s and then entering the 90s, I mean, one of the movies, I mean, there's so many great movies from that era, but like The Cutting Edge was a movie that like my sister and I would watch over and over again. I don't know what it was about. I mean, certainly it was just, it had a great story. I think the whole concept of a hockey player that just turns into an ice skater. I mean, it was just so cool. Did you ever play ice hockey growing up?
No, I was all, you know, I played baseball was my main sport, but
yeah.
In season, I played basketball, I played soccer. My high school didn't have football or would have played football. But so soccer, basketball, baseball, you know, just a normal kind of thing. Back in those days, people didn't specialize in one sport year round the way they do now, which I think is a bad thing. But anyway, so I read the script and it was written by Tony Gilroy. And like I said, I was starting to have some interest in Hollywood. Like I had made a few movies and Lonesome Dove had come out, which was a big success. And so, Tony Gilroy, the great writer, it's his first script. And it's one of those times where an idea for a movie is just so great. You wonder why somebody hadn't made it earlier. There had been other hockey movies, Youngblood, The Great Slapshot, you know, Ice Castles. There had been other figure skating movies. But Tony Gilroy figured out a way to sort of combine The Taming of the Shrew by Shakespeare with a fish out of water story for the hockey player going to the figure skating world. He brought in all these elements of class. I'm the blue collar. She's, you know, the rich girl.
Yeah.
All these, you know, time-tested, you know, binary situations that really come together for great drama. And he just wrote a great romantic comedy. And when I first read it, I thought, this is amazing. I have to be in this. And they gave me the part. And luckily, we got Moira Kelly, who was perfect. I screen tested with several girls, and I didn't have the choice. But she was my choice, and I was really glad they picked her.
You obviously have done a lot. And here we are now in 2024. I want to ask you about your passion and support of our military and what you've done over the years to kind of just reach them and elevate their spirits.
Yeah, it's been a great blessing for me. You know, I started out about 20. Gardens of Stone was a real awakening for me because that's a movie about the old guard, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier guards, the people that take care of Arlington and honor our fallen. I had enormous respect for those guys and the dedication, and I lived with them for a while during the filming of that movie because I wanted to immerse myself into their world. And so I've always had a respect for the military. I didn't serve. My father served in the Navy in Korea. My uncle was a navigator on a B-17 in World War II. That's why I chose the navigator role in that movie to honor my Uncle Tom. And my grandfather was awarded 2 Purple Hearts in World War I for being gassed. And it shortened his life significantly. And he used to have nightmares like, you know, we know it as PTSD. They used to call it shell-shocked. And if there was thunder and lightning, he would, like, hide in the closet or get under the bed. You know, it was really scary for a little boy to see that. So in other words, I'd always had this stuff, you know, in my consciousness. After 9/11, I thought, you know, I got to try. It was pretty clear we were going to be involved in some trouble for a long time. And I thought maybe I could step up what I'm doing to try and, you know, give support in my little way. And it's in the beginning, I did it out of a sense of service. And now I feel like a taker because I spend time around our active duty and our vets. And it builds me up because I feel happy and confident that our country has a future because we still have this small sliver of people who are willing to raise their hand and take an oath and put on the uniform and serve.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty incredible. We love our military here at our show as well. And, you know, just switching gears, I want to ask you a question about your opinion.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, because of the market you're in. Yeah. So I've been to Fort Hood 7 or 8 times. The first time I went there, General Lynch was the commanding officer of 3 Corps. And I've been there through General Funk and you know, and several different things. And it's an amazing thing. And I will say the people in Dallas, they really get it, you know, and like I'd fly into DFW and I'm talking to somebody, say, hey, I'm going down to Fort Hood. And people would be so supportive of that notion, you know, so, you know, Texas is a special place and Dallas is as well.
Yeah. 100%. Absolutely. I want to ask you a question. It's not every day that we get to talk to someone who, and I'm not dating ourselves, but at the end of the day, you've been in this business for quite a while and you've had a nice successful career. So it's nice to ask, you know, your opinion on, you know, growing up, being successful in the entertainment world and just kind of looking at it today, comparing, you know, different eras. And what's your opinion on where the entertainment or Hollywood is today from where it was before when you were active as well?
Well, I feel like I caught the tail end of sort of like the, you know, the golden era of Hollywood. I got to work with James Garner and James Caan and, you know, James Earl Jones, some of these really great people, Ellen Burstyn. But the movies that they've made for the last 20 years or so, they're just not very good because the people who have taken over Hollywood, you know, either by ascending to their jobs or whatever, they generally are children of Hollywood. And, you know, if you look at the great movies of the 70s or you look at, you know, even the eras before that, most people that came to Hollywood had some kind of life experience before Hollywood. They weren't just the children or the nephews of, you know, the people running it. And this is all compounded now by the fact that our performers, more often than not, they come from TikTok or they come from, you know, no training at all. And I'm not saying you have to go through doing whatever 30 plays or whatever I did to be able to qualify as an actor. I mean, there's a lot of, I don't think Robert De Niro ever did theater, but he was so obviously committed to his craft that he got there a different way and one of our greatest actors. So you know, I think there's a lot of ways to get there, but I don't think TikTok is going to create any good actors. You know, you have to become a celebrity on TikTok or Instagram and then actually find a way to become an actor. They're just completely different things. But because the people that run our studios and our casting institutions, they're under the thrall of followers and all this other nonsense, it's not going to get better anytime soon, because they're looking at numbers and marketing and how to make the budget work and how can we get eyeballs. And that's not why you make a movie. I mean, Frank Capra didn't make movies. Of course, everybody always wants to make a hit, mm-hmm. but you make a hit by making a movie that you love and you get people in it. They love it. And like that, you know, The Cutting Edge, that was the story of that movie. Robert Cort was our producer. He produced a lot of movies, some really good ones, some not so good ones, but he was a passionate guy. And, you know, he got behind that movie in the way that old school producers used to. And he really pushed us into the end zone.
Yeah. Speaking of the end zone, are you a football fan?
Yeah, well, I'm a New York Giants fan. So, I mean, I'm a fan until about October 1st when we're eliminated.
You know, I'm a Giants fan too, and I live here now in Dallas. I'm married to a Cowboys fan, so we're like divorced twice a year. But I'm pretty excited about how we treated the draft just this past week.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, you know, the great, I mean, we can't complain. It's not like being a Chargers fan or something where you never win. Like every, you know, we win once every 10 years or so, and then we're just mediocre for 8, and then we're decent for 1. So hopefully this is the year we're either mediocre or we win. But
are you a Danny Dimes fan or no?
Yeah, I think he's great. I love him. I mean, I think he's the kind of guy you need to motivate that fan base. You know, like I'm a huge New York Rangers fan. That's my favorite team. And like right now, you know, we have Matt Rempe, and he's kind of that same. Well, I mean, obviously he's not as key a position, but he's taken that whole, he may carry this team. His energy is going to help the Rangers, I think, win the cup this year.
Yeah, I like that. Well, I got to ask you, I mean, the fact that you played baseball, you played in college, I mean, before you got injured, certainly baseball has got to be still, you know, part, I mean, you got to be passionate. You got to still love the game, right?
I do. I mean, I'm kind of an old fogey in the sense that I just don't like these guys celebrating home runs and the showboating and all that. I mean, I sort of like, you know, I like the Bob Gibson idea where you hit a home run, go to first, get back in your dugout. And if you don't, you know, the next one's coming at your dome. So, I mean, I sort of like that hard-nosed baseball thing. I don't like the first baseman and the guy on first talking and hanging out like friends. Like, hey, what are you going to do? Let's have dinner after. I would rather see that first baseman trying to pick that guy off or hidden ball trick or whatever it takes to win the game. That attitude, I think, has gone out of a lot of sports. Hockey's the last place where I think they still play blood and guts, full speed, even though they're all making $10 million. Not all, but a lot of guys are making, you know, I mean, the lowest salary guy in the NHL is $1 million, I think, if you're in your second year. So there's guys making $8, $9, $10, $11 million, but they don't play like it. Whereas the baseball players, I think, you know, they're like, wait a second, why would I want to, you know, go that extra 10% risk an injury, which could cost me $30 million down the line. You kind of see them playing with that in mind.
It's totally changed. I mean, obviously, it's all about entertainment. Well, I'm going to ask you, since you're an old school guy, should Pete Rose be in the Hall of Fame?
Well, as soon as Major League Baseball signed a deal to make their number one sponsor DraftKings, I think it becomes untenable to prevent Shoeless Joe Jackson and Pete Rose from being in the Hall of Fame. It's ludicrous on its face. You know, that you're saying that gambling is the original sin of baseball, and that's why those two guys are banned forever, and yet you've just made a deal with the devil to pay your bills. So, I mean, you can't have both. I mean, you could stay with Bud Light as your number one, or Coors Light, or whoever, Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
That's your number one sponsor. And then you can say, oh, wait, the third rule is gambling. We got to keep these guys out. But, you know, once you make that DraftKings deal, come on, let's move on. And I think that there's a way to do it where, you know, you let in Roger Clemens, you let in – you know, I've always thought they should set up like a rogues gallery in Cooperstown, and you move Ty Cobb over there. You move all the guys that maybe personally were not great people, but they had great accomplishments over there. And then you kind of segregate them from the Roberto Clementes and, you know, and the Sandy Koufaxes and the good citizens who also were all timers. And I'll tell you what, if they set that up, that rogues gallery would be the most popular part of the Hall of Fame.
That's a brilliant idea. I don't know why I've ever heard of that. They should do that. That's great.
Yeah, and then it's like the Hall of Fame with an asterisk. Yeah. Okay, you're not fully in because you're a scumbag, but you're in.
Barry Bonds or, you know, whoever it might
Barry
be.
Bonds, how do you say Barry Bonds? Barry Bonds may be the greatest hitter of all time. It's probably Ted Williams, once you take Ted Williams' 4 years that he missed during his prime, where he was averaging 350 and 40 home runs and 400 total bases every year, you know, whatever the numbers were, insane numbers during World War II and then Korea. So Ted Williams is probably the greatest hitter of all time. But I watched Barry Bonds several times live and hundreds of times on TV. He would play a game where he'd get four at-bats and he might see one strike and he'd hit a home run. Yeah. It's insane. Like, nobody's ever been intentionally walked as much as him. Nobody's been in a lineup unprotected the way he was. Right. He's the greatest hitter I ever saw.
Intentionally walked when bases are loaded.
Right, right. And I saw him one night in a day game in Colorado, Coors Field, when he was on the Giants. And he had three home runs in the game and a double. And then he was up in the ninth inning with a chance to hit his fourth home run. And they were pitching around him. And they threw a pitch like a foot off the plate outside. And he just lashed it down the left field line. Mm. 5 for 5. I think he saw three strikes. They were home runs. The double was off a pitch off the plate. You know, he was insane. He was otherworldly. So I think it's unfortunate he took the steroids, because he's a Hall of Famer without it. Like, before he started taking them, before his head started growing two hat sizes. You know, his outfield play. I mean, he's a Gold Glove outfielder, great base runner, great hitter. I mean, he's a Hall of Famer without the steroids.
100%.
It's just that, you know, with the steroids, he's probably the greatest hitter of all time.
What's going on these days with you?
Well, it's funny you brought up Francis Coppola before, because, you know, 35 years later, I'm in his new movie, Megalopolis, which is premiering in 2 weeks at the Cannes Film Festival in France. And I'm going to go over there, see if I can find a good hot dog any place. And it's a great cast. Aubrey Plaza, Adam Driver, John Voight. Shia LaBeouf is terrific in the movie. John Voight, I think I didn't say him. Larry Fishburne, Giancarlo Esposito, James Remar. It's one of the best casts I've ever been a part of. Wow. And Francis self-financed the movie somewhere between $100 and $120 million. And this is the dream movie he's wanted to make for 30 years. And it's a really beautiful movie. It's a meditation about the role of the artist in society and what's important about the way people live together. It's like about these big issues. You know, a lot of times you'll hear people complain, movies are all bubblegum and Marvel and whatever. And that's true. And here you got a guy who's like put his money where his mouth is, swinging for the fences. So it's really exciting. And I'm hoping that it gets the reception it deserves.
Wow. Absolutely amazing. I'm looking forward to seeing that one day soon, hopefully. You know, DB, I appreciate your time. You know, I could spend talk sports with you all day long, but I appreciate your career and what you've done for so many people, including myself. Continued success, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. And we just did an event here in Nashville. I'd like to call people's attention to. I'm working with an organization called Creative Vets, which is CreativeVets.org. And we had an event Sunday night. It's about turning PTSD into stories and working with veterans to help them overcome, you know, the invisible scars that can often lead to, you know, our terrible epidemic of veteran suicide. So I encourage people to go to the website. You can see what we did here in Nashville Sunday night, and maybe we'll bring it to Dallas and do it down there, what we did.
Let's do it. Looking forward to it. Come on. Anything for our vets. Absolutely. DB Sweeney, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There you go. More to come live here from Dallas. Stay tuned, everyone.